This is episode 261, The Mistake is Complete.
Come hang out and find out if Justin's maybe not that wrong this time about that mistake being complete while we cover not the Oscars, but yet another 1176 pedal lead and rhythm volumes, not tones, but volumes, tempo and click track stuff, as well as a solid recommendation for Tattoo Aftercare, brought to you by Hustle Butter, which it definitely is not.
hopeful sponsorship from Hustle Butter. Yep.
So just trying that out, see how it felt. Didn't really love it, but anyway, okay. It's the tone control. Bing.
Bing. Catchphrase.
Slurp. Oh.
Ah. Slurp. Fuck.
That's the one. That's it.
That'll be it. Yep. Okay. Oh, man. Hello.
Hello.
Happy everybody wants to tell you about their opinion about clocks day to those who celebrate.
All right. I've been sitting on this idea.
Now listen to Derek's opinion.
No. My opinion is that I don't want to hear your opinion.
You are not a celebrator of everybody has an opinion about clocks day twice a year.
Yeah. I mean, I've been talking about it, too. Hang on, I gotta write that down. My opinion is I don't want to hear about your opinion. No, I've been dealing with this for a while, which is when something happens, right? Culturally, socially, such as daylight saving, singular.
Oh, yes, because on the tone control, we get that shit right.
We get that shit correct. Or election days, or yeah. Things like that, like things that are scheduled and everybody basically does it. I'm really losing patience with, I did the thing. Okay. Like, great. I got it. Okay.
Like the sticker, two. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I did the thing. You should go do the thing. Just, right?
It's a little, daylight it's a saved. Little, you should daylight save.
Did we save the daylight?
Yeah. Right. Did we do it?
Yeah. That and just, I think, you know, we're of this generation where much of our time is spent online, but we also kind of have this memory of early ever onlineness, right? Which was like that stage
sorry,
of
sorry, that's quite a phrase.
You know what I mean? You know, this like
ever onlineness. We invented like, ever onlineness.
That's what I mean. Like we have this proto always online memory of like eating a sandwich, post, right? And you'd like do you know what I mean?
MySpace, everybody top did five. That.
Yeah. Yeah. Top eight, dude. Jesus.
Was it top five?
Oh, boy. It was top eight. But like,
you guys, you
know,
so
and I just know some folks and like, we're in this late 30s range now. And, you know, me and the people I'm talking about, Justin's much, much older than me. But yes, there's just a little bit of like, wow. So at 36, 37, 38, you still post like eating a sandwich. Like, come on, man. Just like leave it alone. Leave it be. I get tired of that, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. Anyway, how's it going over you?
All's pretty okay here. Although I did start a fight with a robot, which I will finish. Mm.
Oh,
I got more on that after the fold.
Speaking of robots, I had a guy come here today, right after work, which is probably the worst possible time, to talk about installing and measuring, like measuring for a new front door for our house, and then like talking about quotes and blah blah blah.
Yeah,
so it's this like door to door thing, and there's we're in the area doing things for the neighbors, and we can offer a discounted rate for all the neighbors that you know that typical.
Wait, was that
bullshit.
Really happening? Because you had been wanting to do something about your door.
Yes. And so they're like, doing windows. Okay. And we're like, I don't need windows, but I actually need a door. And they're like, we do doors. And I'm like, okay, so let's actually talk.
Yeah.
And so that was Friday. And then they got to send a guy out to come and like look at it. And then it was very similar to the situation when we got solar, which is basically the guy who comes to your house is a salesperson.
Yeah.
And they are just giving you the whole rundown on the company and like the agreements and the quality of the products and stuff. They told me it would take 15 minutes. It took an hour and 15 minutes. So didn't love that. And of course, he was like, appointment, we really want both homeowners to be there. And I'm like, guy, I'm home alone all day. Like I can carve out some time in the middle of the day. Like let's not make this annoying. And well, we just really like to have, you know, you and Beth there and stuff. And I'm like, okay, but she doesn't get home until like a little after 5 and we have a toddler.
Yeah.
Who like you when come
this?
When
is this what yeah. you want,
and I was like,
dude?
When you get in, like we're starting the routine, right? Because he's a baby and goes to bed like an hour later. Basically,
you know what? So, like, you know what? The baby doesn't change his schedule around if the door guy comes over for an hour and 15 minutes.
Exactly. So Jack is like, he was being a goof and it was like in a good mood and stuff, but he's like just raising hell the whole time.
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah. So read the room, pal. I got a little bit of a read the room vibe going on here.
Right.
Like, just give me the quote.
His read of the room is, let's add an hour to this 15 minutes.
His read of the room is like, oh man, this is you guys got a great thing going on. Like, shut the fuck up. So anyway.
Stop trying to join my family.
Yes. So, right. So this is such a nice part of town. Okay. Yeah. The guy on Friday said the same thing.
They train him on that stuff. They must.
Oh,
right?
I know. And like, I can see it. And so anyway, I said, speaking of robots, so he hands me his business card when he gets here, and it's got his name and his email and like all just normal business card stuff, but under title, like where you would have the title of, you know, sales engineer or whatever it is, it says human being.
Well, now you know.
Now I know.
You can be sure.
He's definitely a robot.
Yeah, that's the thing. Who fucking writes that on their card? And not a human.
Yeah, it could have just said, definitely not a robot. And it would have been just as believable.
Like, I am human, not snack. Like,
yeah, right.
Human hat. You could have showed up with a top hat. We're inside joking on our podcast about jokes that aren't from our podcast.
So anyway, was just the thing. And I was like,
He's just sopping wet with personality, this guy.
Yeah. He was like nice enough. He's just doing his job. But I was like, look, I don't want you here like at 5 p.m. I just don't, you know, I've got stuff to do.
It's like, listen, it's dude, the if, end you were of the a, day. If you were a door, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah. Like I'm not here to like shoot the breeze about doors and so. Which style are you thinking? I don't fucking know, dude. Like the one that is not expensive. And like our door is a little weird, but it's also like I told him a few times, like it opens, it closes, it locks, it unlocks.
Yeah.
You know, it checks every box. It's just that it's like the threshold's all weird.
Reasonable thermal performance.
Yeah, it's fine. It's just like ugly and broken, but it works. And so it's very... Like, yeah, I'm not in any rush and stuff. And, you know, we might be getting Beth a car this year and we're trying to take a trip for our anniversary and stuff. So I'm like, look, I just got to think about this. And like, oh, yeah, totally. So, and then they get into the second round of discounts, right? Like, well, if you sign today, I'm like, I'm not going to sign. And this is after he gave me the number, quoting our front door and the slider, the back door.
Yeah.
$12,000.
Seems high.
It seems very high. And yes, it seems astronomically high. And I was like, look, that's car money right there. That's like you could buy a whole ass car.
Right. You find the right friendly person. You could buy a whole ass car for that much money.
A whole ass car. Yeah. So
it has four doors. That car probably.
I was going to say, it's got even more doors than my house.
It does have more doors than we're even talking about here.
Have you? Okay. I got one more.
He's coming to you with his two door quote. And you're like, I'm going to raise you two doors, buddy. I'm just picturing like you really light into this guy. You just salesman right back at him. Like, we're just gonna live in a car now.
Look, if the issue is how many doors,
and he's gonna come back at you. But what if we have a five door car? I mean,
right? Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm making myself cry.
It's okay. Like real fake doors. Okay.
It's a hot one.
It's early in the show for Justin to like explode like this. I love
just
it.
Just losing it.
Okay, so have you heard this thing? What do you think there are more of in the world, wheels or doors?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't heard this? Yeah, no. So this went viral months ago now, but it was like this question, just what do you think there are more of in the world, wheels or doors?
Yeah.
That's it. And then it's,
What counts as a door? Are bearings wheels? Oh, my God.
You know who the biggest wheel manufacturer in the world is?
No. What?
Lego.
Lego. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just see, from my perspective, we said that at the same time. I don't know how much it's going to come out of the recording. Because on my perspective, I said it, I realized the answer and said it the exact same moment as you. Anyway. Yeah.
So now the new version of that is, what do you think there are more of in the world? Eyeballs or legs?
Ooh, it's got to be legs. Because of arthropods, they have way more legs than they have eyeballs. And there's a fuckload of them, way more than there are people. In fact, there's way more of stuff that has more legs than eyes.
Yeah.
I know this one for sure. Yeah, no, I got it. We have 2.2. Oh, 2 and 2. Yes. Oh, thanks, Eric. Yeah. He's figured out how many eyes and legs he has. You know what? This guy's fantastic. Look at him. He's right there. He counted it. He's like on the ball with how many legs he has.
God, he's on the ball with both of those legs.
Ball with both legs and both eyes. This is going to be a hot one.
This is an all new way to say eye on the ball, you know?
Yep. Eye on the balls and the legs. What?
Eyes.
No. Yep.
Hey, man. What's going on?
What's going
is
on?
It okay, time, so is it here's the time what, change that's making us all hot and bothered?
I don't know, man. I had like a serious, like, I'm so tired now for no reason rush at like 4:30. Like when I got home with my kiddo, I was like feeling rough and I bounced back. I don't know. Maybe. I felt like I was impervious to it. But then again, the only thing permanent about this world is change. And I'll tell you what, human bodies, they change a lot. And
you know what else is pretty permanent?
I'm old as fuck, as we've previously discussed.
My baby waking up in the night. Yeah. That's pretty permanent. So time change, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
You know what your
baby doesn't,
once again,
baby doesn't give a shit about? Time changes.
Time changes, yeah.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Big mistake. Anyway.
Big mistake. We had we had the electrician finally came and did an install for a brand new 50 amp circuit straight from the straight from the panel into the garage. And so now we're charging the EV on that instead of on 120 volts. It charges in like minutes on this. Like it's shocking. Awesome. Where we used to, it would go all night and it would usually be like almost full after whatever Marielle's been doing driving around. She gets home, we finish dinner and I'm like putting something out in the recycling bin and I can see that green solid light already full again. It's ridiculous. Awesome. But
that rules.
Here's the thing. The day after we got that put in, Marielle's in a hurry to go somewhere. She's bustling about, takes off, and I hear this like crash or crack and something falls on the floor. And I'm like, what the fuck? She like
should they have it plugged in?
Hit something? She hit something? So I poke my head out the garage. No, she didn't leave it plugged in, but she unplugged it and then didn't close the charge port and just backed out and ripped that port door right off the car, off this brand new car. I was so mad. I was so mad. And
wait,
so the thing
car?
Is,
the new car?
Yeah, the new one, the charge port.
Oh, jeez.
And it's like right on it's right in front of the driver's door. It's like on that front part of the car, and she just doesn't close it. So I'm like, well, shit. I was like, well, first of all, you can't take this one because this isn't watertight now. You can't take this out. You got to take the other car. She goes and does her thing, and I start making plans. I'm like looking up. Now, the part, the assembly for that, like the plastic pieces and the surround that makes that little door is only $50. But you got to take the fender off to get at it, which for an experienced person is an hour and a half's job. Mm-hmm. And what's under there is stuff to do with the charging system. So there is 390 volts of there are no mistakes, there is just kill yourself under there.
Yeah.
So I start thinking, maybe I don't, you know, maybe I have Chevy do this for me, which is going to cost hundreds of dollars and I get really pissed. And then I start thinking, I'm a grown-ass man. maybe I try to fix it. And you know what? If I fuck it up, then we have Chevy fix it and
her, then we know.
And
yeah.
The mistake is complete. So I went down and got some of this. I got some high structural strength plastic epoxy.
Good.
And
smart.
And
you
some,
just glue that bitch back on.
And some finish nails. And I glued it. And then I laid in finish nails and put more epoxy on those and layered in three layers of epoxy over essentially rebar. I basically did concrete rebar into the back of this thing.
Yeah.
And you know what? It fucking worked.
You know what's the best? When you fix something in a way that you're like, I don't know if this is going to work. And then it does. Yeah. And you're like, of course it fucking worked because I'm
and
a
it's
genius.
Like, it's probably so strong that if it ever broke again, it would break in a different spot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I have just reinforced it so much stronger than it was. And I'm like,
it's a real
I
primal
man,
feeling.
You know?
Like it's,
yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. And this happened to me. I mentioned this on the Dad podcast, Super Secret Dad Club, by the way, new episodes every Wednesday.
Super secret. Don't fucking tell anybody.
Don't fucking tell anybody. That reminded me of a really funny meme, but I'm not going to recount it right now.
Okay.
I changed a headlight in Beth's car, like sometime over the winter. Yeah. And that's an easy thing. That is a thing that kind of everyone agrees you can do at home for the mm-hmm. most part, unless your car is like really weird and you got to take the fender off to get to the headlight or something like that, you know?
I bet I would with this fucking car. Anyway.
So I ordered the bulb too, because I'm not a dummy, right?
Well,
because
they come exactly.
You can buy one or two on Amazon. So I'm going to get two in case, for whatever reason, the other one goes, I break the first one. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
Options. I'm like, yep. And then Beth's like, I'm going out. I got stuff to do all day. I got a whole Saturday. I'm like, whatever could possibly go wrong in this headlight change, I've got the whole day.
Yeah.
Got the whole fucking day.
Right.
Like, bring it on, right? Like, let it fail. Let me need to drive to AutoZone 8 times, right? And I changed it. I took my time and changed it in 20 minutes or something like that. And I was like, all right. Now, I was real, like, caveman, make fire kind of. It felt very, very
make
primal
light,
and
yes.
very, yes. So that was good. That was fun. Anyway, the meme
I thought you were going to tell me something was going to go wrong.
No, it didn't. And I was I was so like happy and proud of myself. Like, yeah, I did it on the first fucking try. No problem. After watching a 2-minute YouTube video, it took approximately 2 minutes.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You want to know where all the little clips are because otherwise you're hunting for the clips and invariably you miss one and then it cracks and you're like,
snaps,
well, now when I put this back together, it's slightly weaker. And I know that.
Yeah.
Even if nothing ever comes of it.
Yeah. The meme I mentioned a minute ago that I'm now going to recount.
All right, it's meme time, yeah.
It was like, had a really great time at my first Fight Club. Got there a little bit late, so I didn't catch all the rules. But yeah, totally would recommend Fight Club.
Oh, my God.
I love it.
All right, let's fire up a sound and tuck in
podcast?
Here, right?
Podcast?
Yeah.
So I asked around, what should we talk about? And somebody was like, talk about Slash at the Oscars. And I was like, bold of
Wait,
you to assume.
Wait, did they say that or did I say that? I said
somebody,
Slash.
Somebody mentioned to talk about.
Somebody.
There was a performance at the Oscars involving Slash.
Okay. And, right on.
And Wolfgang Van Halen. And I was like, you know, pretty bold of you to assume that I watched any amount of the Oscars.
Yeah.
So, I hate to disappoint, but like. I don't care.
Yeah, I didn't watch the Oscars either, but I did watch exactly the number of seconds that were occupied by the song that Slash performed in.
Okay.
Because somebody told Marielle about that, and she was like, huh? And I think it was like on YouTube seconds later kind of situation because the show was barely over. Ryan Gosling performing his song from the Barbie movie, and then Slash turns up at the end to do it.
I unfortunately have not seen the Barbie movie yet. I really want to.
Yeah.
So I kind of don't want to hear the song. I haven't heard the song either. And I kind of want to I don't want that to be the first time I hear it. So I didn't go find it because I was like, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, I didn't. That's all I've seen anyway. So whatever. I don't know what
Slash
what would
was
we
at the
about?
Oscars.
Yep, there he
I
was.
Guess. His guitar, maybe.
Yep. He
had
guitar.
One.
Yep, he had one. And
it appeared electric in variety.
That's the story with that.
heard about this new pedal.
Do you so pedals, huh, Derek? What do you think of this? So yeah. do you mean this pedal right here? This
I do mean this one.
This Wampler Ego.
Yeah, I think they've made
Ego. It's Ego. Definitely I think, Ego. Pretty no, sure. I can tell it's Ego. Yep. I can tell.
E-G-O, Ego.
Ego. Just like they my made, daughter wants to eat in the mornings. Yes. Ego.
Eric is in the chat and can correct me, maybe. Wampler made the Ego prior to this, right? Like there was their compressor was always called the Ego, I think. Is this maybe a new version?
Well, the Ego 76, I can almost guarantee, means that it has something to do with the 1176, right?
You are correct, Justin. So it is, but it's specifically based on that all buttons in version.
Ah, the nuke mode or whatever. Yeah. All buttons.
So mode. Like, is that different enough? I threw this in the notes basically because like,
it's pretty different.
Are the features here like cool enough that we want it in a pedal?
So here's the thing. What I'm looking at here doesn't square with that at all, but that doesn't mean it's a bad pedal. And I'll tell you why. Actually, I'm formulating these opinions right now. So the all buttons in mode is this sort of like compound ratio, like the 1176 is a hardware unit and it had these radio buttons for the 4, 8, 12, and 20 to 1. Or the available ratios. And if you trick the thing to push them all in, I don't really know for sure if it's actually doing all of them at the same time or if they're sort of cascading into one another, but it makes it this kind of crazy mode that sounds like it does. It's a very, very strong, intense form of compression. It's very effecty. It's not something you would just put on a vocal or whatever. So it's a thing that's often like, aha, all buttons in mode, you know, but it's something you definitely use for effect. It's a crazy sound. It's not the main sound on any of your instruments, you know. Okay. What's funny about this is like the blend and compress knobs. Like, I don't know what those are. Those don't track to what would be on an 1176, right? You should have an input and an output, but, you know.
Well, it says here the compress adjusts the ratio, but if it's...
If it's all buttons in mode, then what do you, what, you know what I mean?
What are you adjusting? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it explains it. Wampler put out a video explaining all this stuff. I'm sure it's mentioned there, which I did not watch because I'm a professional podcaster.
Yeah, we're not going to investigate that just for the sake of commentating about it authoritatively.
So it says here in the article, it has a tone knob, which is for tone shaping.
Yeah, I bet.
In case you were curious.
Most of the tone knobs, I think, most tone controls are for that.
Mm-hmm. It's got a blend though, which I think compressors should have blends. So that's nice. But also this, we were just talking about this like some months ago about should the 1176 and compressors of the like be put into pedals and put those pedals on your board. Right. It had kind of fizzled out and then this showed up in my feed and I was like, oh wait, are we not done with this conversation?
But okay. So here's the thing I'm coming around to though. This might be a much more appropriate compressor to put in a guitar.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah. Because I think the place we're landing, and there was this great video that I shared in Discord at the time because it came up because YouTube is listening. Somebody basically did this. Somebody with access to the equipment did this and basically said, like, all these pedals are, or all these studio compressors are being put into pedal form. Is this something we even want? And I was like, yes, exactly. And they basically compared them all to like an appropriate guitar compressor pedal. And mostly what's happening here that they discover is that the guitar compressor pedal is really affected sounding compared to these studio compressors that are fairly transparent, harder to hear the difference. They do less, sort of, you know? So what when you put it in a pedal form, it's like you want it to be this crazy thing. And here we are, right? You know, a crazy thing has been now been put in a pedal. So maybe this one's going to work, you know?
So, question from Eric, should it go at the very end of the board in that case?
You know, that's still going to depend. At the very end of the board, does that mean it's after like reverbs and stuff like that? Because probably not, right? You'd want it before that, unless you don't. See, this is the thing. Like, do you put it before your dirt or after your dirt? So you put it before your dirt and what you get is a more even sound feeding the distortion. You're not going to get... you're going to get tons of sustain, but you're not going to get a stronger distorted attack that fades down, right? It's just going to be forever. Yeah. And it's never going to go higher than that. You put it after the distortion. Now you're letting the distortion be a compressor too, but you're evening some things out. So you're kind of getting less variation between signal notes and chords and stuff like that out of the distortion.
What about, so he's mentioning after an Iridium or any other amp modeler, should it go after amp and cab emulations as though it were headed to the control room?
I would say yes for the regular ones, like a regular 1176 copy in a pedal form, definitely. Yeah, put it after, because that's what it was designed for. That's what that circuit was designed for. This one, maybe not. You know, maybe you put this one after it and suddenly you're in super effect mode. Like the nuke sound is like, that's what you do for like the one bar drum break sort of sound where it's crazy for a second and then the song comes back, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Or you use it, but you blend it very minorly. And this has a blend knob, right? So you put this, you put the nuke mode on your drum bus, but you just blend it in a little bit and you're adding sort of this thickness to the background without really changing most of the sound that's happening. So I don't know. This sounds like it could work, especially with a blend knob.
Yeah. Well, it's $180 bucks.
Yeah.
Kind of right in there with pedal prices. I think it's
okay for the Wampler kind of zone. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right on. So that's it for show. That's it for the show.
That's it
for news. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a really great question come up in Discord. I think it was actually in our recording channel, Rabbi Bob. Now Rabbi Hasselhoff has asked.
Hold on. No, yeah, I'm gonna sound this. Yeah.
Yeah, hit me with it. Wicked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he has asked basically, how are you people who play on stages, he's asking, how do you navigate the difference between your rhythm tone or rhythm volume and your lead volume?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always made them the same. I never wanted to be different volumes. Is that weird?
That I think that's weird.
Yeah. I was probably doing it wrong.
Because for lead, well, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it depends on the kind of band you're in. Because like a band like Circus Survive, right? Circus Survive, both guitarists are playing lead all the fucking time, right?
Right, that's true. I didn't really do much lead stuff, but there were times when what I was playing wasn't the chords part of the song. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but I never thought of it as this is supposed to be on top. It was
the only time
it was
I think
a little
about
more Circus Survive-y where it was like, it's part of the background, but it's like,
part of the
like
riff.
Coheed. Like, listen carefully to any Coheed song, and it's just
there's
like
lead all over it.
The whole song's just lead the whole time. Two different
ones. right. And Gaslight Anthem, there's rhythm and lead, and the lead is all over. It's not just solos, it's like all over. So maybe you're not wrong. I don't know. Hey guys, maybe Justin's not wrong this time. I think though, like it depends on, so if you're doing that, then there's your answer. They should probably be pretty close. But I think in the spirit of the question, I'm assuming it's for coming up for a solo.
Yeah. Right. And I know that Rabbi was he was doing something with some programmed sounds, right? We're using a modeler. So like I think the answer is to have a volume pedal, right? Like, I think players who are really good, that's what they would be doing, right? They wouldn't just have their volume pedal dimed all the time. They would have this, like, modeling. Is that what you do, though?
It is.
Yeah.
Because I know I shouldn't, but I when I'm using a volume pedal, I keep it up all the time. And then work from 100% back down for other sounds for, like, Because I put volume first in the chain, so it's before drive, so you can get these like edge of breakup things more easily on a foot pedal. So that's why I do it that way.
But you don't have a second volume control that's essentially modulating the post sound, like everything.
I don't, but on Helix you can, because there's two expressions. There's a switch under the foot under the treadle thing, so you could do it. I just don't like that. I would rather it be like switchable. Just it's volume A and then it's volume B for the loud part, for the lead part.
Yeah. And that's more predictable, I guess, and something you can sort of feed to your sound mixer and just be like, okay, here's my deal, you know? Because that's the thing that I'm setting people up for, I guess. The way I think about this is like, you're going to do a sound check and then you're going to hit your sound person with +6, you know? And they're going to be like, well, what the fuck? And I mean, I think probably that's not a problem most of the time with guitar sounds because they're just not very peaky. Yeah. But I don't know. You know, I don't mix live shows all the time. Maybe that would piss somebody off.
But if you're coming in with +6 and it's clearly for a guitar solo and then it's going to go away, is that even still a problem? So I don't know enough about decibels and how they're measured and all that stuff to say like how many dB more you should be. But I don't really think that's the goal either. Like, I don't know if you can really quantify it that strongly.
For the most part, slightly frequency dependent, but 6 dB sounds like twice as loud to a human.
That's pretty fucking loud.
Yeah, but actually you might be surprised how little twice as loud is in the context of music, right? So it's loud, but like if you hear one gunshot and a second gunshot and the second one's twice as loud, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's twice as loud. But you wouldn't be like, the first one was nothing and the second one hurt me. You know? Yeah. Unless you're getting
shot. That's when it hurts.
Right, that's when you get hurt, by the way. Just info for you kids out there.
Yeah, this is we cover a lot of ground on the tone control. It's music, sometimes it's how to get injured by guns.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know.
wait, which side of that are we on again?
I think it's just facts, man. I think it's just like...
Okay, that's right. Our information has no morals or...
It has no agenda. It's just like, if you want to get hurt by a gun, get shot by one. Why am I saying this?
This is not going well.
This is not... Why? Anyway, so, I'm going to... Let's just dial this all back.
The point is 6 decibels. It's very, very good. It's a very good decibels. You should all be into that. So how do you navigate your lead sounds, Derek? I mean, come on.
So I'm thinking of this in the Helix platform, you know, of like when you can go in and be like, give me more of this range or give me more, this many more volumes, right? Yeah. Give me this many more decibels at this stage in the signal, which you can also do with traditional pedals and stuff. If you have like a EP booster or something like that, that'll give you like what, 12 dB at the end of it, like when it's maxed
probably
out.
Probably more than that. The EP, that motherfucker, I bet it's 20.
I actually sold mine. But actually, what? I think you're right. Wasn't using it, and it's in Helix, and it sounds the same.
Now somebody's using it.
Yep.
Three gunshots worth.
So I would like have my... First of all, figure this out while you're playing with your band, because that's how you're going to know how much more you got to come up by. But I do it by way of... adding some effect or something that is foot switchable for a lead section. And in things like Helix, you can do this by adjusting the master volume of the amp or like doing it with like traditional sort of analog controls in the Helix equipment. Or you can just straight up assign Helix to get louder. Just send more volume of everything, like from the output jack. Make the output jack louder. So there's a way to...
Oh, so it's like not even in the patch. It's like after the patch. Yeah, you're sort of... Yeah. It's like a trim. You might call that a trim. Yeah, okay. Cool.
So there's a few ways to do it. I like to do it in the guitar brain kind of way, which is like for my lead sound, I'll... bring the amp up and maybe add a boost. And just so it's like it, because the amps aren't, when they get louder, the EQ changes as well. So because it's modeling all those inconsistencies. So it's not just more. It's just like, on this amp, when it's at 10, the mids are crazy, right? Or there's no bass or something. These things happen.
The approach is, because this is how we would have done it with an amp, and it would have had these alterations to the sound, so we're doing it that way here, and it follows, right? Yeah. So this is sort of the way of, it's still, we're replicating in digital rather than doing something different in digital.
But I think, exactly. So I think that goes to say you could do this all with analog too. So it's not just that it's software-based, but I usually start pretty low by like having the lead thing come up by like 1.5 dB or 2, you know, and just go from there. A lot of times it works out pretty well.
Yeah.
And I will also on that switch tend to add some other effect. usually like a very, very slow chorus or a the tape emulator is really the best thing for this job in, as far as the Helix universe goes. But because it gives it a little bit of something. There's a little bit of motion, but you can't hear it because nothing's really sustaining. Yeah. And the tape saturator doubles as like, as it says on the tin, saturation.
Saturator, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. No, I'm going to hit on that. You finish.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Oh, okay. That's my trick is to use something like a tape saturator.
Yeah. So from a slightly different perspective, I feel like maybe the answer is you don't. The rest of your band gets a little quieter. Right. And this is a little bit of interplay.
That's pretty hard to do. Yeah.
It might be, but with some band compositions, I think maybe it wouldn't be. It might just come down to, you know, it's almost like a jazz sensibility where somebody's taking a lead, so everybody else is just going to ease a little bit. Right. And it sort of makes that the feature in that sense. So that's possible. I'm not saying that's always the answer. But then from like a recording mixing perspective, the answer is usually everybody else gets a little quieter. Because a lot of the time, especially with rock music, we're pretty at the wall already, you know? And then the solo is going to be coming out of a chorus, which is the biggest part of our song. We're already max big. So everything gets a little quieter, and then we do something like you're saying, something exactly. Yeah. Like we're adding some interest, we're adding some saturation, we're using like a delay where we weren't before. Maybe that's enough. I mean, a compressor.
Well, Eric just mentioned using a fucking
compressor.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Eric
louder
mentioned
without
our slapbacks,
being
a slapback or echo. That's also a really good tip. Any sort of like short, not slapback, like country chicken picking slapback, but like these arena rock kind of like very light repeats that are totally not in the way of your playing. And they're just adding this like extra support underneath. So, I'm reluctant to say like it's this many decibels. That's what you should target because I don't think it really is going to work that way. But yeah, hang out like with your other guitarist and like both of you kind of back and forth, work something out to see how it feels. And when you go to play loudly against them, you know, we're on top of their playing, this other person's playing. Is it overbearing? Is it not enough? Like you'll figure it out from there. I think. You compete with cymbals a lot. Any thoughts on that, Justin?
Me personally? He's accusing me of competing with cymbals. Yeah, good. Let me add those cymbals. No, guitars compete with cymbals? I don't think so. Really?
Well, in a live environment, like cymbal wash on a stage, I don't know.
So I think that kind of goes back to like my thing of your band should know their own song and know that this is not the moment to be absolutely ruining the day of the cymbals, right? So this is the moment to actually like do the jazz thing and draw the sound out of the cymbals without breaking them in half. Like that should be that moment for sure.
Yeah, I think.
They can get really washy on stage. Absolutely, it depends on the room, right? Anything other than a giant room is going to just fill with cymbals instantly.
Mm-hmm. I think he's talking about playing covers in the original question.
Yeah.
So yeah, like when the song is the song, like don't stray from that, and that will certainly help. So I don't know. I think this kind of covers the topic. It's a really good question because when playing at home and learning songs, I'm not really concerned with that stuff. Like, I'm not thinking about that to like, oh, I got to learn the solo. I never really end up being like, let me dial in a lead bump for this. Mm-hmm.
It sounded like when he was bringing it up, it sounded like this is a situation where he had been playing at home. This is the first kind of going out and playing with people in a while kind of thing. And he hadn't really thought about the relative levels of all of his patches. So, and then in going through and trying to kind of make sure they were relatively the same, he had this idea of, oh, wait, maybe I shouldn't be making them the same, right?
And
it is something I think we're coalescing on it eventually here. But yeah, it's trying some things out. I think it's this all of these answers might be right.
Yeah, Eric in the chat, trial and error, trying things one song to the next. Absolutely. Like I think it's just that you have to be ready and willing for that stuff. One of the things that I think is that some guitarists do that feels like kind of security with your setup is to have everything really locked in and not and not movable.
This is a good point. Yep.
You know, and I think you to
and you're afraid have, to touch it at that point.
Yeah, and so I think that is a you should probably get away from that if that's if you're doing that. I think this is just my opinion, but because every room is different, and because you just got to be ready, you know. And I think mm-hmm. being able to say like, well, my lead sounds bad because the room sounds bad because you won't touch your amp knobs. Like that's not cool. Don't do that.
Yeah. You know? That's true. I experience the same thing sometimes mixing. If I have four yeah. songs from a band and I get the first one sounding really great, you know, the temptation is to then just go like, I'm going to just like import my settings from the other yeah. song. Well, that's useful as a starting.
Photographers do that.
Sure, sure. And it's yeah. but it's useful as a starting point. And likewise, you're going to go, okay, I'm ballparked. Now, but yeah. I have to be okay, like flipping a few knobs. And I definitely, for a long time, I felt precious about that. It was like, but wait, that's my kick drum sound. You know what I mean? I don't want to move those by those settings by half mm-hmm. a dB. But like, it doesn't always sound the same in every song. And once you know, let go of that, this is like episodes ago, we were talking about, I was talking about how I've been mixing in Luna with these. This stuff that's all built in with knobs and it's not graphic EQs.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it a lot easier to let go of that feeling of I have to have the graph look exactly the same from one song to the next. And now it's like, well, but on this song, the kick drum actually doesn't sound like it has enough low end. And even mm-hmm. though in my brain is screaming at me, but you nailed it. Don't touch it because yeah. you're going to fuck it up, right? And it's like, well, actually, no. It's that this song has a different tempo.
It's a different song.
Or whatever, it's a right? Different,
yeah. Yeah, maybe it's not as high energy and they didn't hit it as hard. Like there's a
the
million things.
The bass player is playing in a different key. Now there's room for a different kick drum sound. You know what I mean? It should be yeah. adjusted.
Yep.
So the same thing's probably going to go and it's going to go song to song like you're saying. It's going to go room to room like you're saying. So yeah, that's something... Yeah, I don't think I've ever got that way with analog amps. They're too easy to spin the knobs. I knew about what it should look like to be my normal sound. Like I could return yeah. to the practice space every time and my sound was instantly correct because I'd memorized that position, yeah. but I was never precious about changing it in the moment at a show.
Me neither. So yeah, because I had been in bands with people that were like, oh, no, don't touch the bass knob. Don't touch the bass knob. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like that yeah. is, you cannot live your life that way.
They worked on that bass knob setting for... It's like the amp sounds like shit until you get it to 11.6 and 11.7 and 11.5 are fucking garbage.
Yeah,
you know what I
yeah.
mean?
And yeah. I just don't, that's not how guitar tone works. And it's not like to say this is how guitar tone works is a stupid statement. Like it just, you cannot really quantify it, but I can tell you what it is not. And it is also, yeah. it is not that. So mm-hmm. I do this with Helix too, like we get to a place, I mean, we're using in-ears though. This is really different, but like my ears always sound the same.
You really can't hear the difference between the 11.6 and 11.7. Yeah. That's what you're trying to say.
But like when I got the AC30, I had played it at home without being in a band for years. And then I joined a new band and brought that amp. So I was like, I had no baseline of like my knobs are here, right?
Yeah.
It was like, yeah. I'm coming to a band. I got to turn this amp. I got to like bring it up. And it helped with this sort of, you know, I'm going to go to the room. I'm going to go to the venue and start playing a little bit and see how it feels. And most of the time that meant there was like not nearly enough lows or something. Or, and I would just like turn that until it's got more and I like it. You know, it doesn't need to be this whole exact thing. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of good answers in there. And also the correct one is probably just a compressor is the answer.
It's probably 7.9 dB.
Here's the thing. It's probably a compressor. But all those answers are valid, but the correct one is that it's a compressor.
And a tape saturator.
And the reason it's a tape saturator is because that's a compressor.
Yeah. But give it that little
guess what? Cyber saturation is compression.
I know, but it's got it's the
modulated pitch adjustment, compression, like, isn't it? Yeah.
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 No, stuff anyway. Like that is sincerely good, but yeah. Cool. That's
so great. You added to the notes. Give me a sound.
Okay. Do you want to do this? Do we have time? That's fine with me.
I mean, how long are you going to take?
I'm not going to take... Well, I'll take as long as... Well, you know what? We'll just do it. Well, this is another...
Tempo and click track.
kind of discussion that we had in sort of, it was sort of about specific things, but we can take it more generally. But this is just something I've been rolling around in my mind, and we had been talking about Discord. So I thought, like, with a very short bit of show notes, I just thought, I don't know if we have a topic. Yeah. So tempo and click track. This comes up because, like, I encounter people sometimes who are wanting to record, and I want to, you know, I ask them a bunch of stuff to get it to know what we're getting into. And one thing is, like, are you guys going to use a tempo track or a click track is what I usually call it. Some people don't. Well, I guess it's a sign of what the answer is going to be if they don't know what a click track means. But what I'm talking about is essentially a metronome. But when you're recording, the computer is producing the click, and you can tempo map them too. Play along to it. They don't have to be steady. You can tempo map them. The thing about it is, over the years, music, popular music in the I was like going to say anatomical sense. Yeah, like in the sense of it's not classical music or jazz. You know what I mean? Like, okay, popular music means it's sort of this grand, like, category as far as sales are concerned.
Sure, so
technically, like, all, you know, rap and metal and all this stuff falls under
Metallica,
that category.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? Yes. So that style of music that isn't orchestral music, you know, uses a tempo, like it has a locked in tempo. There are exceptions, I know, but, like, for the most part, over the last, you know, 6-7 decades, we've just gotten more and more used to hearing this, like we've gotten more and more used to hearing things being perfectly in tune. And that that doesn't mean all singers are auto-tuned to within an inch of their lives, because frankly, like, singers get better because they grow up hearing auto-tune, and that's a snowball, right? Mm. And the tempo thing is a snowball too. Like, singers sing more in tune now than they used to.
Right, because they can sing along to a song on the radio and hear that they're out.
Yeah, they just grew up with that being the sound. And everyone, so we've all done this. We've all grown up and grown accustomed to this. And nowadays, because music is better now. Yes, Eric. I mean, technically correct. The best kind of correct. It's like, so when I listen to the Beatles and there's shit in there that's out of tune. First of all, the Beatles' tempo is pretty great. It's for being in the era where they weren't using metronomes all the time, right? Mm-hmm. But their pitch, and it's not like the pitch of the singing, although there's places where I'm like, you know, nowadays it wouldn't fly. They're pretty good. There's plenty of records that are, like, famous. I'm looking at you, Rolling Stones, that are all over the place in tempo, and it's repugnant to me. I cannot do it.
Honky Tonk Woman is, like, the one that always stands out to me, because you can feel it changing in the bridge. Yeah. It goes faster and faster and faster, and by the end it's like 20 BPM. it's way different. It's a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot. And
Here's my take on click tracks and tempo tracks. When I first started playing guitar, my guitar teacher was like, metronome practice, as guitar teachers do. And I was really bad at it, because I was also really bad at guitar, you know? And I was, like, really focusing
on the core of it now, Derek. Yes.
I was bad at both things, and trying to focus on them together. I was like, I'm losing the beat, like, off of my internal beat. That, like, they're not the same, you know?
Yeah.
So that, like, was kind of hit or miss for many years. The thing that really nailed it
probably
in for me was...
Probably gave you a bad taste for many years.
It did. And I was like, metronomes are like, because you're always thinking, like, is it faster than I think it is, or is it slower? Then you start playing and you're like, God, this is way too slow, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that. So I started playing along to all my favorite songs and albums and stuff like that, in learning those songs to get better at guitar. And guess what? They're on a click track. So, right, you're playing along to drums, feels way more fun and organic and better to, like, develop that skill, which I didn't even know I was doing. It was sort of like an adjacent, like, knock-on effect, right? Mm-hmm. So that worked out really well. And I think anybody who is skeptical of metronome practice, go find a drum loop instead. Like, just go to YouTube and search for a drum loop. You're way better off, and it's way more comfortable and natural. So
make one for yourself in GarageBand or whatever.
Yeah, totally. And change it around. Like, make it faster, make it slower, make it in 6/8, mm-hmm. make it in 12/8, whatever.
It's the extra information between the beats. It's the stuff that you can put in a drum beat that's not just doom, doom, doom. It's a boom, pa, boom, pa, boom, you know, those extra little bits of information make it much easier.
There's just more reference points for your ear to latch on to play in time, right?
Yeah.
And I think I end up being one that likes a more, like a higher subdivision of clicks in my click track. I want to hear like the double time of the click against the halftime of the drums.
Yeah.
Just because it's like that's allowing that space for more information. Yeah. I don't play to a click at home. Like, I do not practice to a metronome. I play with drummers that do, right? Mm-hmm. And I play, or the whole band is on a click or something. I still play along to like recordings that I am learning. So that helps with that. But I think the thing is, you got to be ready to play to a click. Because when you go someplace and it's there, whether it's a new band or you're going to the studio for the first time and you're unprepared, it's really difficult to master in that moment, like right then.
It's stressful moment.
It's stressful. It's like kind of embarrassing, right? There's a bunch of things about it that you're like, oh, this is an area of music that that so many people ignore. And for good reason, honestly, like it is kind of a drag. But yeah, I think you just got to, like, I don't pull out that tool out of my tool belt very often. But when I have to play to a click, I'm like, I love that I'm in it. Like, I love that I have it. I love that it works for me. Like, yeah.
It's bike-like. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it will be hard at first if you're not used to it. There's a lot of people that still have this sort of aversion. And a phrase I heard recently, not to pick on anybody, but like the phrase basically that was said back to me is like, you know, we don't want to use a click. We want to let the music breathe.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. Part of it is probably maybe you've tried it and it was difficult. And so that puts you off. But maybe you also have this cultural idea that it's stifling to the music, that it makes it robotic, which is absolutely 100% false. There is no room for discussion here. Absolutely not. That is not where the humanity and the feeling and the emotion is coming from in your music. In fact, if you're varying in tempo, you are subtracting from the power of the rhythm in your music.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's it. And so anyway, big encouragement to, if you haven't practiced with it yet, it will be difficult, but it's bike-like. It will click for you at some point, pun intended, and you will feel better. And like you said, you don't pull that out of your pocket all the time. Well, but you've got it. Like when you do pull it out, it's like, here I am again. And once you get over the hump of it's difficult for me and it makes me uncomfortable, it makes me wiggle in my seat, then it's a comfort instead. It immediately switches to being a comfort.
Corey Wong of Wolfpack and like all these other music project, Fearless Flyers, all these things, he's got a lot of YouTube content about, like, he does live mixing sessions and stuff and is just doing a lot about guitar practice and rudiments and things like that, which is very cool. And he is a grid guy. Like, he is on the grid for everything. And I challenge you to find music.
I bet his music is emotionless and flat, right, Derek?
It's painfully dull. No, it's fucking great. Like, I challenge you to find music that has as much vibe as what Corey Wong is doing. Right. And tell me it's not on a click. Go fuck yourself. Like, it's just, mm-hmm, I say that in jest, but like, for real, it's really, really strong and it's really, really helpful. So yeah, like having that space in between allows you to just have more to reference, but also know, like, if you're going to riff for a second, you know exactly how much room you have to do it. And you can kind of set yourself up for success with that by not overshooting, right? Not overestimating the space. So I was going to say, like, I know some drummers that in the past have been like, I'm the click track, right? It's very prideful. And it's very like, I don't need a click track. I'm good enough that I will not waver, which, like, I believe that you believe that, but it's just not true.
Right.
And It's fine. Like other drummers I know are also like,
this is a different set.
A different set of drummers. The pros are like, I would really love a click for this song, or like love for this part. I need a click. And I think, I don't know, like another trick that might make it a little easier for you is maybe if you're struggling to start with it, don't add a downbeat, right? Just have clicks. So you can feel what it's like.
Oh, you mean the accented beat. Yes.
Yeah. Don't have the accented beat in the click. Because every now and then it would happen to me where I'm like counting it wrong and the high click is the 3 in my brain and I can't get away from it for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so by removing the accented click, it can sort of help break into this in some ways, I think. And that way, if you do waver,
that can be helpful.
You can find a new click again. Yeah. And still be in time with like the band, right?
And all
one
of that,
BPM drift.
Yeah. Right.
One all BPM of that drift is okay. Over a whole song is like whatever.
Yeah. All of that is okay with me. Like if we're working on a song in the studio, first of all, I'm not going to make somebody play to a click if they're not into it, because I don't want to create that discomfort. This is not the moment for them to be discomforted, right? So I want them to be rehearsing for that ahead of time. If they're not ready, then we're not doing it. I'm going to probably give them something to start with. And then when they fall off of it, and they probably will, I'll just fade it down and I'm going to let them go. And what's happening is that doesn't mean I'm going to let the song vary, because if I need that song to kick ass, then I need it to rhythmically kick ass. So I am going to edit that and grid align that song. That is what I do. And, you know, because when, like I said to them, when you sign with me, I am going to produce something, you know, when you're going to leave with something that kicks ass. So I'm not going to leave it to maybe your performance will be in time or not. You're going to do the best you can with the tools that I can give you.
If this performance has to kick ass, if playing in time is what makes this kick ass, then we're going to do it. Yeah. And it might be a bear. But
yeah.
Eric's mentioning that there's been theater.
Hit.
Yeah, he's saying there's some theater runs that have had programmed tempo changes over in-ears. Like, there you go. It's not just rock music. You know, it's
with
not
a conductor.
Just,
and the conductor is following the click, because you better be damn sure they are. They are if they know what they're doing. For sure.
Yeah, it's not. I think I just wish people didn't think of it so much as like a thing to correct you, because people don't like to be corrected, right? It's a thing that can
that pejorative word. Yeah.
Yeah, I think people think like, you need a click because you can't play in time, which is not true.
No.
Like that's not, no, a click lets you play in time.
Right, that's a good comment on something you said earlier, where it was like a good drummer, or the drummer that thinks they're so good, I'm the click. A really good drummer accepts the click into being part of what's happening. And, you know, the comments that I've heard from drummers once, especially if they didn't used to do it and then they became accustomed to it. And now it's like, oh, I love the click. Do you know why? Because I don't hear it most of the time.
You don't,
because when they're playing in time, the drummer doesn't hear it because they're hitting those beats, right? And then it's just a little guidance. They'll probably hear it a little in the fills, because the fills are where we're going to go off a little bit. And the fills are a great place to do a little bit of human push-pull. And depending on the style of music, a little bit of that is acceptable. But it doesn't mean, like you said, the word overshoot before. If you're overshooting a solo or a fill, it means you got there too fast and now you're having to pull it back. That ending beat where you're having to pull it back, no, you should already be there. So the push-pull needs to happen within the frame of reference for that, because the ending beat is just as important as the first one. And all of that is like, you have to think about people, whether they're dancing in their head or dancing in their bodies while they listen to the music, it's that. It's the variance that is going to fuck up that dancing. Don't fuck up the dancing. Let your song be awesome. And don't, you know, just accept that the click is not what's holding you back. If there's something holding you back from your music breathing, it's not the click.
Yeah, it's not a punishment. Practicing it can feel like a punishment, but it's not. It's a very, I think it's a you don't use it every day, obviously. It's not like, I think ear training is something you can do and use every day. Click, maybe not so much, but super, super valuable. And it's like super, super, I don't know. It's an important thing. It just is. And I don't know. I have this, I've mentioned this before, like when I'm working on a project, whether it's music or not, I want to know everything ahead of time that I can. I want to be set up for success. So when there is a problem, it's not with me, right? I don't want to be the cause of any slowdowns. I don't want to be the cause of any headache or whatever. And if you roll into a session and you can't play to a click, like that's what I mean by it feels embarrassing, because then it's like, oh, this guy can't hang.
This guy can't hang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The metronome will never lie. It is honest. It will always be there for you.
That's true.
So I've told people,
the metronome won't abandon you.
Yeah. And the thing about not being able to hear it is true, because you're fucking dead on with it, you know?
Yeah.
But also it takes a part of your music thinking and working and playing brain and removes that responsibility. Like you can just, I don't have to think about the time. The metronome is thinking about the time. And the rest is, I'm just having fun playing within the sandbox that the metronome has created for me. So.
Yeah, it's a path. It's a map.
Yeah.
You know?
We sound really smart.
Is this good? Did we do a good segment?
I think so. I think we sound like really cool about this.
Yeah.
My sister is a music teacher and is like a orchestra musician.
You think
type
she needs
thing.
To hear this lesson too, right?
Well, I'm really curious about her take on click because I think a lot of the stuff she does is far more conductor driven.
Yeah.
And not so much like metronomes are more of a practice tool in that world, I think, than they are a performance tool. But I don't actually know. So shoot.
Yeah, well, okay. It would be interesting to know what she would say. What I immediately think is there isn't always a machine generating the tempo. The click in that case is the conductor, right? So there is still a guide that the whole orchestra is staying on. It's just that a person is doing it.
It's a human,
But we've seen these performances where, like you said, in this theater where you have a click in your ear, in any of these performances with where they're doing the score to the movie. I've seen half a dozen of them now of different movies. Now, the conductor, they're still a conductor, but they have the movie on their screen in front of them with their score, and there's this visual
the
white bar that's giving them bar cue lines and tempo cues, and the when the tempo changes for the next song, the conductor gets this advanced thing, like the next one's going to come, and it gives them a quick little 1, 2, 3, 4, and It's
awesome.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So in those cases, it is a machine, and there's still variants, and there's still all kinds of stuff that's happening that is appropriate for the music. Like I said, I can program tempo changes into the recording software, and I do. Although most of the time when a rock band comes in and they think their song has tempo changes, it does not. They were just fucking up. And I just kind of go, oh, and they're like, oh, there's a tempo change here. And I kind of listen and go,
oh, it's just a triplet you're playing too slowly.
Right. Sometimes I give them a little, are you sure? Or like, let's just try it and see what happens. Or, you know, I let them record a pass and then I edit it so that it doesn't change. And they go, oh, that's right. And I was like, they're like, what tempo was that you edited it to? And I'm like, I didn't change it. Right. It's like, oh, now that the realization, right, can happen in that moment that actually it's just that we were varying too much at practice and we thought our song had a tempo change. And then sometimes it does. Sometimes it's like, oh, this is like a 2/3 breakdown or whatever. And it's like, it is important that it's a tempo change. But, you know, anyway, so there's all kinds of these things. But the conductor, anyway, the point is, back to the orchestral music, the conductor is the tempo track. So in a sense, they're more used to it than the garage bands are.
True. True, true, true.
Yeah.
Thing of the week.
Thing of the week. You're assuming I have one. That's all right. We're going to find out. We're going to find out. First of all, we're going to play a sound. Did I do that already today?
I think so.
I think I did the same one twice. So what the fuck is this, Derek?
This is Hustle Butter.
Hustle Butter. Oh, you got it right here. I don't need to show the website.
I got some in my friggin' hand.
Your big cam there.
Yeah, so I got this. This is Tattoo Aftercare product, and it's awesome. I love it very much. It's a non-petroleum-based product, which is nice because, you know, don't want to be gunking yourself up with petroleum too much. Yeah. And my tattoo artist for my most recent thing, tattoo, we call it, was using Hustle Butter products. was using these products during the session.
That's like a soothing cream for when it's even happening right then kind of thing.
Yeah. So it says for before, during, and after right on it. And it's like the, it smells
skin
like
skin poster.
My new skin poster. Yeah, we call them tattoos or skin posters, which is freaking looking sick, yeah. By the way. My band, I'm like all mostly entirely healed up. Yeah. So this is interesting stuff. It's like the texture of frosting. So it's not thick. It's thinner. I'm sorry. It's thicker than lotion, but it's thinner than like Aquaphor or something like that. And so as you work it into your hands and work it into your tattoo, it warms up and spreads very easily. And it smells really great.
So it almost like phase changes a little bit on your skin.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
So it's got all kinds of good stuff in it. It's mostly like a shea butter-based product with others like coconut oil and some mango in here, which is an allergen, by the way. So if you're allergic to mango, don't buy this. Mm-hmm. But
I've heard of people being allergic to mango, actually.
Yeah. So she used a bunch of their stuff when tattooing me, which includes like... this cream, or like this balm, as well as some soaps and some other things, just for like kind of calming, soothing skin irritation stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was really nice. And so I grabbed this. They sell it at Ulta Beauty, which are all over the damn place. And you can just go to the mall and get some.
My wife just placed an order from there.
Yeah. So
she needed something. She needed something to make her into a pretty person.
Oh, what'd you say to that?
I said, why are you buying makeup? You're so beautiful. You know, what any good husband would say.
Yeah. Something for her skin poster? she doesn't have any tattoos, does she?
She does not. Although a couple of months ago, she sort of like mused about it one Sunday afternoon. And I was like, that's very interesting because I think that was the first time I've heard her talk about it in a way that wasn't just like, oh, I could just never do it. It's too much of a commitment, you know? That's the thing. It's a commitment.
When she says that to you, say like, what about me?
No,
because that's the thing. Yeah, like, it's a commitment, but what about your marriage and like your kid? That's a pretty big commitment.
I think isn't it funny? Like, since we're talking about tattoos, I guess, but that psychological thing of... And I think you have some thoughts about this, but like the psychological thing of tattoos seeming like the biggest commitment that you could ever do in your entire life because of the permanentness of them. And yet you bring up all this stuff and it makes a lot of people like either just have an aversion completely or just be, I think, you know, when you were getting your first tattoo, you spent a long time, exactly, like thinking about like, is this the right design? It wasn't that you wanted one or not, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It was the commitment aspect. And it's like, I wanted to talk to you about it because you've had tattoos longer than you haven't. And I kind of wanted to know, like, how do you feel about them today? Right. Like that's a good perspective to have. I've had my first tattoo for almost a year and I love it.
Yeah.
You know, still good. It's still very cool. Yeah. So, I think I personally approached a very, very quickly approached a, like kind of fuck it, life's too short, you know, thing about it. And now that I'm in it, I like them a lot and I'm glad I made that kind of commitment and stuff because I don't know. It's a little bit like if I grow to hate them, which I don't see happening.
Yeah.
Then I'll deal with that then, right? It's not really about. I don't want to look forward and expect doom and gloom about this. But anyway,
so, I think it's in everybody's different kind of situation because I'm sure there are people who don't like their tattoos later, and it's not just because they tattooed the wrong person's face. You know, there's a lot of good reasons to not like to decide later that you don't like a tattoo, and that's totally fair. But
whatever the reason, it's the right reason. Like you don't have to justify it. It could just be like, I'm tired of this. That's a good reason. So, it's fine. And I know there will be people that say like, well, you should have thought of that before, blah, 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 blah. Not the point, right? We're kind of missing the narrative here. So anyway, get some hustle butter. It's also good, Justin, for...
Sorry, I was reading the chat. Shouldn't have done it.
Okay. It's good for existing tattoos, like old tattoos. So grab some.
Right on. Okay.
And it's like $20 and it's a big tub. It will last you a while. And it just feels nice. It doesn't stain your shirts or your sheets. It doesn't get all greasy like Aquaphor or other things can.
That's nice.
It is nice. And
technology advances in all sectors, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Shit.
Yeah.
Shit. Yeah.
I've been doing this twice a day. I'm going to put some on when we're done here. And it's just feels nice. It smells good. I like that I smell nice. It's great. You know?
Firing on all cylinders here. All right. I'll tell you what. I'm going to thing of the week. I'm going to say JB Weld Epoxy and brush up on your homegrown engineering skills. I felt a little Mark Rober-y about the whole thing. You know, I was like, how am I going to make this so that it's the most structurally sound that I could? And I was like, I can do this. I can figure this out. Like,
I watched the video last night.
Yeah.
I watched a video last night that I'm going to send to you later to watch tonight because it's fabulous. A guy, I like to make stuff, turned a TV and server rack into like a Star Wars style prop console that's fully functional.
Oh, right on. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Here, I'm going to get your ad off the thing. Now I'm going to put it on the podcast. This stuff, this is the stuff I use. There's a bunch of different kinds. This is the tan kind, which is structural. So it was supposed to have the most, bend strength. Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is epoxy's cool, man. You gotta like find a paper plate or something and mix it up and whatever
that's
it touches.
That's so cool.
Whatever it's you know, it's like this materials, man. And you gotta mix the two parts and by golly, whatever that touches, it better be either what you wanted it to touch or something you're gonna throw away because it is never coming off. Anyway, whatever. The point is you can fix stuff. You can do it. We can repair things. We don't just have to buy a new TV, you know? Let's go back to the old days.
Just like see Justin's TV. It's like I had a bunch of shit stuck to it.
It's like, let's just replace the power supply on this TV. It's perfectly fine. It's like, Justin, that's a 13-inch tube television from 1988, you idiot. It's barely got color.
Still works.
You're suffering in silence. Okay. What's happening now?
I think we're done. I think we got to get out of here. This episode started high and then like evened out and then came up high again. It's like an inverse bell curve.
Quite a ride. Quite a ride. Okay.
Mid-scooped the episode.
We did it. We mid-scooped the episode. Fantastic. So so then all that's left is to discuss our great and glorious friends, and that is the audience of the show, which may happily come to the Discord channel and also sign up for our newsletter. There's just all kinds of things that one could do if one wanted to, and also the Patreon, and become a supporter.
Yeah.
So wait, this is an off episode, which means we need to come up with a new giveaway for next episode? Is that what I said we were going to do? Maybe? We'll see. Never mind.
No, I think we said like every four, right?
Every four episodes. Yes, every 2 months. I thought that was a good schedule, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and we gave some strings away last time. So yeah, hop in Discord and get on the newsletter because that's when you're going to hear about giveaways and stuff the fastest. So yeah, those will be coming soon. And head over to Patreon. You can support for as little as $1 a month and then just go up from there for all kinds of goodies. So the supporters this week are Rabbi Bob, Gabe Droll, Carson Ricketts, Matthew Fenslaw, pause for effect, right? Risen Wolf, Brian Gower of the Tone Jerks podcast, Andrew Walsh of Andrew's Alcove, Sean Wright of Lollygagger FX, Doug Gann, and because of this, Bon Jovi.
I'll never understand what's going on over there, Eric, but, you know, you keep being you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep doing it, man.
That's it. Be careful scooping the mids. That's all I got to say.
Don't scoop them out with epoxy. They'll stick somewhere you don't want them.
All right, bye.
See ya.